now more than ever, people need to go within and plug into that cellular memory, plug into divine source, detach as much as possible from the matrix. Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're listening to Bartley's Commentaries on the Cosmic Wars. Well, today I'm going to talk about a subject that's come up in the recent past. I only became aware of it, about a year or so ago. Along with the flat Earth, there's this other meme that's been gaining circulation in the alternative research field. And this one is, nuclear weapons are hoaxes. So I want to address that issue and talk about where it may have come from and why it's being passed around and why I feel that it's a complete hoax in itself. There seems to be an effort on the part of the nuclear weapons are hoaxes crowd to capitalize on the fact that more and more people are waking up to the Zionist, tribalist, collectivist agenda. If you go to these YouTube channels which claim that nuclear weapons are a hoax, their thesis seems to be that, well, Jews created nuclear weapons, ergo, the nuclear weapons must be a hoax. The nuclear weapons were created, the hoax was created as a means to scare people and terrorize the world, etc., etc. It's a clever bit of reverse psychology by putting out this notion that because Jews, i.e. Robert Oppenheimer and many of the others that were involved in the nuclear weapons development, and later on the hydrogen weapons development, people like Teller and Feynman, et cetera, because there were Jews, then the whole thing must be a hoax. Okay, that seems to be the meme, and it seems to be utilized to exploit the mass awakening towards the tribalist collectivist agenda. Because if Jews are behind the creation of nuclear weapons, then of necessity it must be a hoax, it must be fake. Because we know that for a long time, the mainstream media, the entertainment industry, etc., has always, and also academia, has always painted Jews to be smarter than anyone else. Albert Einstein, a patent clerk from Switzerland, right? Ben Rich himself says that they corrected Einstein's equations, and now they freely travel the stars. And then you look in a movie like Independence Day. Who is the one that saves planet Earth from the invasion by the meanie aliens? The mean, mean, bad aliens. Of course, a Jewish guy, Jeffrey Goldblum, right, is the actor who played the character. The Jewish guy who came up with the idea in the movie that if you use a computer virus, you'll basically wipe out the entire alien fleet. Well, I would say if the entire alien fleet was using McAfee computer protection, yeah, I could believe that. There is this meme that has gone on around for a long time that Jews are inherently, of necessity, smarter than anyone else, and that's why you have these terms like, oh, he thinks he's another Einstein. Oh, what are you, a Weisenheimer, i.e. like an Oppenheimer? Okay, so I feel that part of the strength, power behind the nuclear weapons are a hoax meme is precisely because more and more people are catching on to the reality, the tribalist, collectivist agenda, and which, again, everyone should realize that whether this archontic agenda manifests as Jesuits, that's another meme that's been going around. Oh, it's the Jesuits that are behind everything, or it's the Freemasons behind everything. When Freemasonry was basically created by the Talmudic types, the tribalist collectivists. And people always have their own particular pet group that is behind all this, right? But ultimately, we must remember that whatever human form these perps may take here on the surface, whatever hybridized human form, ultimately the source of all this mayhem and miasma of suffering and pain is non-human in origin. Always remember that. reptilian, Draco, Mantis, Greys, etc., etc. Now, I want to talk about something that happened not too long ago, not too long after the 9/11 false flag attacks. And for the record, okay, some of you have heard me say this before, I don't think planes were utilized as hijack weapons. I've talked about this before. There was the whole backstory created by the whole Bojinka, Ramzi Yosef, the master terrorist plot to hijack a bunch of planes, which was supposedly uncovered in the Philippines and all that. And I mean, really, why should they complicate the operational scenario? By even if they use drones, why would they complicate the operational scenario when they can just tell everybody what happened or tell everybody what to believe in? We've seen this with the Boston Marathon bombing. We've seen this with Sandy Hook, Aurora, Colorado, right? San Bernardino shooting. It's questionable whether any of these things happened the way the lamestream media presented it. The only people that were killed in Boston were those two unfortunate boys who were basically coerced and manipulated into taking part in what they thought was a drill to protect the country, ironically, right? So, you know, the poor Sarev brothers, I think that's how you pronounce their name, were total patsies of all time. And Boston Marathon, complete hoax. That's been completely dissected. So the point of relevance is, why complicate the operational scenario by having all these planes hijacked by a bunch of different tangos who can't even fly planes properly, right? I mean, the whole Flight 93 let's roll thing is so preposterous. I don't even need to go into that, right? And then you have a little tiny, you know, debris field in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. Complete nonsense. Okay, back to the concept of nuclear weapons. I already said that. Oh, the point of relevance also is, let me state that I don't think there was any planes hijacked at 9/11, but I do think Thermate, the military version of thermite, which basically burned up the core support structures, I also think that a directed energy weapon was utilized, because the thermate and all the charges that were set off at Ground Zero doesn't account for why cars a mile away from Ground Zero were popping like popcorn, and for some of them, only one side of the car or truck or fire truck was melted or warped, and the other side was perfectly normal. And doesn't explain why all of this paper was floating around that didn't catch on fire, that was right next to some of the vehicles right at the ground level that did catch on fire. There was a lot of weird anomalous stuff that was going on. Certainly some of the papers, you know, caught on fire, but you know, there was some strange, unconventional, let's say, things going on at 9/11. So for what it's worth, you don't have to believe me. You make up your own mind about these things. I don't believe planes were utilized. Do not believe planes were utilized at 9/11. I believe that there were thermite, as determined by the analysis of people like Stephen Jones, et cetera, et cetera. But I also think that directed energy weapons were used, right? Anyway, as far as nuclear weapons are concerned, I feel, and I felt at the time, although I didn't have a lot of information to back it up, I felt, based on what little I had learned, the October 12, 2002 Bali bombing, Bali, Indonesia, was a mini nuclear weapon, because a lot of the hallmarks of a nuclear weapon were there. They were interviewing one guy. He was some military guy, and he was saying, well, yeah, right before the explosion, suddenly all the power went off. Well, that smells like a kind of EMP burst or something that took out the nearby grid, and then a split second later, the charge goes off, right? But there was a huge crater. A lot of the bodies were completely vaporized. They never found a lot of the bodies, even in very powerful conventional weapons. Conventional explosives, you will find body parts, right? But You know, not only did the authorities fill in the crater at Bali, but a lot of the victims were never found and no traces of them whatsoever. So it has the hallmark of a low-yield nuclear weapon, and these low-yield nuclear weapons can be calibrated to a relatively low-yield explosion to a higher one. They can go up to, you know, below a kiloton yield up to 7, 8, 10, whatever the case may be. They realize they can develop micro-nuclear weapons as they were developing the hydrogen bomb. The development of the hydrogen bomb came on the heels of the development of the atomic weapon at Los Alamos during World War II. They called it at the time a fission fusion weapon. Now, I, for one, don't buy into the core of the sun as a nuclear furnace. I think that's nonsense. I believe implicitly in the electrical theory of the universe, the plasma electric theory of the universe. So just because I cite the fission fusion concept of using a smaller nuclear atomic weapon to ignite the nuclear fuel, deuterium, for example, inside of a hydrogen weapon, it doesn't mean I ascribe to the core of the sun as a nuclear oven or whatever nonsense that is. I want to make that clear. But the point of relevance is when they were developing the first fission fusion nuclear weapons, thermonuclear weapons, basically they would ignite an atomic weapon, what they used to call atomic weapon in the old days, now they call them nuclear weapons. They would do it in order to ignite the nuclear fuel, which would generate a far stronger explosive yield, a thermonuclear explosion, when these lighter elements would fuse together and create a tremendous explosion. In the process of developing the fission fusion weapons, they realized, well, these small nuclear cores that we're making, what they call a primary, used to set off the hydrogen, they got the idea that, well, we've already miniaturized these. Why don't we start making what has later been called backpack nukes? Now, there's a lot of disinformation about that. There's people in the field who say there's no such thing as backpack nukes. But I would disagree, okay? I've spoken to people, ex-special forces, who have been trained to deploy so-called, they're not really called backpack nukes. They were called SADM, small atomic demolition munitions. And Army engineers, some select Army engineers would be trained in them. Army Special Forces would be trained in them. Navy SEALs would be trained in them. And probably others in the Spec Ops community. It was not so well-kept secret during the so-called Cold War that DET A, ODA, the Operational Detachment Alpha, so-called A-Team that was based in West Berlin during the Cold War, it was kind of an open secret amongst military circles that those guys in the DET A there in West Berlin had backpack nukes where, if need be, they can set them off, right, in the event of the Red Army and their Warsaw Pact allies taking over. And there's also other forms of evidence which I would cite for the reality of nuclear weapons. I'll get back to Bali in a moment and the point of relevance here. At this point, all I'll say is that the reason why Bali happened was because Australia and some of the other, you know, countries in Oceania were, let's say, relatively lukewarm to the whole concept of, you know, joining this whole war on terror, right? This bogus war on terror. So hence you have the Bali bombings, and that kind of bull rushed the Australian government and any other government, you know, that was lukewarm. See Spain and their, you know, false flag attack there, and et cetera, et cetera. I've spoken to atomic veterans who were in the Pacific. Actually, the Pacific is where they tested fission fusion weapons and later hydrogen weapons in the Nevada test site. As far as I know, they've only tested nuclear weapons, first an atmospheric test above ground, and then at the Mercury test site below ground. If you have an aerial view of the Mercury test site in the Nevada test site, you will see the whole area pockmarked with huge craters because they've been setting off nuclear weapons tests in the Nevada desert for some time. As a matter of fact, I was at a UFO conference, the International UFO Congress, in the early 1990s. This is the first time I met and befriended Dr. Carla Turner. Leah Haley was there, one of the first MyLabs who went public. Daryl Sims was there. Most of the whole Southern California, Southwest UFO research crowd was there. It was a memorable week. But anyway, I was in the exhibition hall where there was a bunch of books set up, and anywhere where there's a book sale, well, you'll find me, right? Just to digress for a second, I don't know if they have them now, but back then, years ago, every year in Phoenix, like the Nurses Association or something would have a huge book sale there in Phoenix. It would take up like gigantic convention hall, millions of books inside, and they'd only let the crowd in 100 people at a time. And I got there on the very last day. I think it was going for 4 days. And anyway, when they finally let me in, I was running through that book sale like, I'm in Elysium. I felt like screaming out. Anyway, back to the UFO International Congress. I was there in the exhibition room where all the books were, and suddenly the ground started shaking, but it was very brief. Happened very quickly. I go, that's unusual. Didn't think much of it at the time. I just figured, okay, there must have been an earthquake in Southern California somewhere in the high desert, and we feel it here. But it was unlike any earthquake I'd ever felt, okay? I'm an old Californian guy. I've went through many, you know, earthquakes in the magnitude 3, 3.5, 4, 4.5, 5, 5.5, and up till the Loma Prieta quake, 1989, October, I was sitting there waiting for game 3 of the World Series to come on, and the ground started shaking violently. I held onto the TV for dear life because I figured if I somehow survived the ordeal, but the TV got thrashed, I wouldn't be able to watch the rest of the World Series. Okay, I had, you know, priorities, right? So the point of relevance is I know earthquakes. And so when that the ground rapidly, quickly was jolted in Nevada when I was there for the International UFO Congress, I thought it was unusual, didn't think much of it. Had a whole week there to hang out and meet with people at the Congress. Find out, not too long later. In fact, I think if memory serves, I found out at the conference, somebody mentioned to me that, hey, that was a nuclear test that went off in the Nevada desert, right? And it would have been underground. Now understand, back in the day, it was the thing to do in Las Vegas. This is before it was all built up like it is today, right? Before, you know, you could drive a little ways out to the desert from Las Vegas and you could see the mushroom clouds go up in the sky. That was like a thing to do back then, right? So, and remember I told you that when the ground shook, it was a very fast jolt. It was unlike any earthquake I've ever felt before. So, and then I thought at the time it was unusual. And then shortly after, I was told that it was an unacknowledged, unpublicized nuclear test underground. And I've spoken to nuclear veterans, who were in the Pacific when they were testing thermonuclear weapons. And the guy who told me this was a Navy veteran, a Native American, very switched on individual. He said there were UFOs flying all over the place in the days leading up to the nuclear test, during the thermonuclear test, and after the thermonuclear test. And we've seen a long-standing interest in on the part of these alien civilizations and nuclear and thermonuclear weapons development. So it's one thing to hoax the people and say, oh, well, you know, nuclear weapons aren't real because the Jews invented it, therefore it must be fake because everything about the Jews, yada, yada, yada. But they must be really good hoaxers because they fooled the aliens too. There's a book out called UFOs and Nukes. If anyone out there is in combo with Robert Hastings, please put him in contact with me. Let him know I want to interview him because I left a message on his website. He wrote the book UFOs and Nukes. In fact, he contacted me years ago and we had a short email exchange, but I haven't heard from him since. And he hasn't responded to my entreaties to come on to the switch. Anyway, his book, Robert Hastings' book, UFOs and Nukes, is about UFOs and their interest in nuclear weapons. And there are many people now who've come out over the years, and there's a lot of formerly classified documentation. The book by Fawcett and Greenwood, Clear Intent, which was since republished as The UFO Cover-Up. Lots of declassified documentation in there about particularly the November 1975 UFO wave in the Northern Tier Strategic Air Command bases. Malmstrom Air Force Base, Minot Air Force Base, Grand Forks Air Force Base, and all the way in the East Coast, in the Northeast, Loring Air Force Base. These were all Strategic Air Command bases where nuclear weapons were stored. And some of them were ICBM bases, the Minuteman bases. And these Minutemen would be spread out for miles and miles and miles. This was so that if one or few were, you know, struck by a ground-level Soviet warhead launched by a ballistic missile, the other ones, in theory, spread out over many miles, would still be functional and would be able to be launched. But actually, the U.S. has always had a first strike, first launch strategy. Anyway, Clear Intent / UFO Cover-Up documents this. Priority messages went out about these UFOs that were having low-level incursions into the restricted airspace over the launch control facilities, right over the ICBM silos. Sabotage alert teams were scrambled. Eyewitnesses on the security forces had seen on one occasion, I forget what base it was, Malmstrom, I think it was, or Minot, I can't remember exactly which, a large reddish football-shaped object glowing brightly hovering over the ground. And then there are the books that have come out, like Faded Giant. Robert Salas, Lieutenant Colonel in the Air Force, he was at Malmstrom in 1967 in a launch control facility. And he talks about how something like 16, maybe up to 22 different ICBMs went into what they called faded giant status. In other words, they went into no-go status because these UFOs were flying around the nuclear launch sites, the missile launch sites. Let me read you something from the book Faded Giant, co-written by Robert Salas and James Klotz, regarding a similar incident at Minot Air Force Base. I think in North Dakota is where Minot Air Force Base is. This was related to retired Sylvania engineer and longtime UFO investigator Raymond E. Fowler, who also was an alien abductee. Raymond E. Fowler wrote the classic series of alien abduction books called The Andreasen Affair, The Andreasen Affair Part 2, The Watchers, Watchers 2, etc., about Betty Andreasen and her family. It's a great series of books. Anyway, Raymond E. Fowler was a Sylvania engineer who worked on nuclear missile sites during his career. And I'm quoting from the book now. Raymond E. Fowler reports meeting a Strategic Air Command officer who was present, quote, in the launch control facility that was affected, unquote, at Minot during the incident. This Air Force officer, who was adamant that his name not be connected with the incident, went further in describing the effects of the UFOs on communication systems than the documentation available in Dr. Hynek's Mano incident file. Fowler reports the unnamed officer stated concurrent with UFO sightings over the missile installations, quote, all types of highly sophisticated communications were instantaneously jammed on all frequencies, unquote. This officer's opinion was, according to Fowler, that, quote, it would take a non-earthly technology to accomplish what the UFOs appeared to do, unquote. This unnamed officer also stated, two F-106s were scrambled, and when they approached the object, it outflew the jets. Then you have the shakedown cruise of the USS Franklin D. Roosevelt, 1958. Only a relative handful of people knew that nuclear weapons were on board. And throughout different parts of the maiden shakedown cruise, UFOs were following or showing up around the, and one of them was a cigar-shaped craft that came very close to the ship. And then we have stories from the B-47, and I think there were B-58 bases in places like Lakenheath, RAF Lakenheath, and Mildenhall, places like that. Can't remember exactly which base, but the stories that have come out were about these American planes that had left with nuclear weapons, had landed, and right when they were landing, a UFO would hover right over the plane, and then later on, when they would examine the plane, they'd find out that the nukes were missing, right? And then there's also the other instances when nuclear weapons were dropped. This happened off the coast of Spain, where there was a tremendous covert rescue operation to find those missing nukes. And that wasn't the only time. That's happened on other occasions too, where these planes would be flying around and either the plane would crash or somehow the nuclear weapons were jettisoned. And then there would be this mad scramble to recover the nuclear weapons. So all that has been going on. So if this is a nuclear hoax, they fooled the aliens. And then, of course, you have Bentwaters, which at the time it happened, late December 1980, Bentwaters housed a large quantity of tactical nuclear weapons. And for three successive nights at least, in the end of right around Christmas, December 1980, RAF Bentwaters and the nearby Woodbridge, RAF Woodbridge, right there in the Rendlesham Forest, were besieged by UFOs, landed UFOs, reports of ETs coming out of landed UFOs. All of that was covered up. And then you go back to Project Twinkle. I talked about this before. There were people like physicists like Luis Alvarez, who was involved in the Manhattan Project. He was part of the scientific team that was there as Project Alberta in Tinian, where they assembled the nuclear weapons there before they nuked Japan. And they had the SED, Special Engineering Detachments, made up with Army engineers with high security clearances that were trained to assemble these nuclear weapons on site. Luis Alvarez was later part of Project Twinkle. Project Twinkle was a top secret project involving Army intelligence, Naval intelligence, Air Force intelligence, the Atomic Energy Commission, etc., to determine what these green fireballs were that kept overflying these sensitive Atomic Energy Commission sites like Hanford, Washington, Oak Ridge, Tennessee. Hanford was where they were developing the plutonium-239 that was used in the second nuclear weapon, the plutonium device. Oak Ridge was where although in both sites, both plutonium-239 and uranium-235 were created, manufactured. Hanford is more well-known for the plutonium-239, and Oak Ridge is more well-known for the uranium-235, all the cascades and the centrifuges to, and also Lawrence had placed a lot of his big centrifuges there, not his centrifuges, but his cyclotrons, his electromagnetic isotope separation process, utilizing really big magnets to separate the fissionable uranium from the U-238. That was at Oak Ridge. And there is not only, you know, different UFOs seen over there over the years, but also these big green fireballs, right? And so they put together this top secret project called Project Twinkle. And people like Edward Teller were involved, Dr. Luis Alvarez, Manhattan Project veteran. I think he was, Alvarez was also involved in the development of hydrogen weapons, if memory serves, right? So whoever was piloting or remotely guiding the green fireballs, they were fooled too by this nuclear hoax. So you can't say, well, you know, UFOs don't exist, ergo that just strengthens the argument for the nuclear hoax theory. It doesn't work like that. There's another issue that needs to be addressed. There's the downwinders in Utah who have become irradiated from the nuclear, well, when they were having above ground nuclear tests, and it's continued because with underground nuclear tests, the fallout, the radiation will still leak out into the atmosphere. But the people, not only in Utah, but well, wherever the prevailing winds carry the radiation, would get sickened. There has been a marked spike in the 1950s and 60s when they were setting off a lot of these tests, lots of them. In the days, weeks, and months after these nuclear tests, there would be a marked spike in the incidence of childhood death. This was long before the mega vaccination dosages children receive today, where sometimes, unfortunately, they'll die within days or hours of these mass vaccinations when they get hammered by multiple vaccinations at one time. But this was happening before then, where these nukes would go off in the atmosphere. And then in the days, weeks, and months afterwards, there would be a marked spike in the death of toddlers and infants. Also, we have to take into account the atomic veterans, okay? And I'm only talking about America here. There's other countries that have been subjected to above-ground atmospheric nuclear tests, like Australia, Montebello Island, if memory serves, Maralinga. They had the nerve to steal a Koori original people, you know, word for thunder from the sky, Maralinga, and then they turn it into a name for a nuclear test site, right? Aboriginal people, you know, reporting this big black cloud coming over their territory after nuclear tests, and people getting sick and dying, and the Royal Australian Air Force personnel flying in and out of atomic mushroom clouds, and the Australian sailors on board Australian ships that were near the nuclear test out near Montebello Island getting contaminated, right? And then in America, you have the atomic veterans, the soldiers that were ordered to conduct maneuvers at ground zero in an above-ground nuclear test multiple times. Troops doing maneuvers at ground zero within an hour after the nuclear blast, many of them coming down with leukemia, various types of cancers, dying. And then the military covering it all up, saying, no, our records say you were somewhere else, you know, when you claim to have been a test subject in these nuclear tests, right? Or they'll say, oh, you know, our records say that you left the military before these nuclear tests. So they're lying and changing the documentation for the medical, the military records to show that these people were not even there when they claimed to be present at these nuclear tests, and which they subsequently develop all these chronic illnesses from, cancers of various sorts. So people can say, oh, you know, nuclear hoax, but they can't make a wave a magic wand and make all these people who've been sickened, died from all these nuclear tests, go away. And the French have conducted nuclear tests in French Polynesia. the crew of the Lucky Dragon that was present offshore when the Americans launched a multiple megaton yield nuclear weapon. I think it was the very first time they, not nuclear, but thermonuclear. I think it was the Mike test shot. It was a very large, unwieldy, impractical, you know, deliverable, non-deliverable device. But nonetheless, it generated this gigantic explosion. And not only did it practically vaporize the island on which it had taken place, they'd had to move a lot of the island's inhabitants to some other islands. Many of the people in the nearby islands got sick anyway, but the crew of the Lucky Dragon, a Japanese fishing boat, you know, they had all this ash fall from the sky and contaminate them, and many of them died and became sick. So it's one thing to say it's a hoax, but you can't wave your magic wand and make all these atomic veterans, military personnel, all these civilians in America, in Australia, elsewhere, who were irradiated from these nuclear tests. You can't make them go away. And then you have the espionage. The code name for the Soviet espionage effort was Enormous. First, the GRU, the Soviet military intelligence, was the forerunner, the front runner for atomic espionage. And then for political reasons, Stalin appointed Lavrenty Beria, the head of the NKVD, the predecessor for the KGB. Stalin appointed Beria to be the head of the Enormous code name Soviet Atomic Espionage Program. And they recruited many atomic spies. Theodore Hall was an atomic spy, a young Jewish kid. And he was recruited. His friend was a young Jewish guy in college. Theodore Hall was in Harvard, if memory serves. And his friend had talked him into becoming an atomic spy. And then you have all these other spies that were in Los Alamos and in other places. It's been even alleged, I have no reason to doubt it, Robert Oppenheimer was an atomic spy himself. He was known to be a rabid commie going back to his Berkeley Caltech days when he was a professor at Berkeley and also at Caltech in Southern California. He was he would even organize fundraisers for the Communist Party. He was alleged to be an atomic spy. There was a number of people that were recruited by Soviet intelligence, first the GRU, and well, they continued to recruit spies, but the whole spying program was taken over by the NKVD, Enormous. And as a result of all this intelligence they gleaned from atomic espionage, in 1949, the Soviets detonated their first atomic weapon, which was basically a carbon copy of the plutonium device, codenamed Fat Man. This was the device that was dropped on Nagasaki. It was a plutonium implosion device where you would have lensed, prefabricated explosives that were built around a core, a what they call a pit nowadays, of plutonium. And the implosion, this symmetrical shockwave that blew inwards, which perfectly compressed the core so it reached criticality, well, they received all that information. Klaus Fuchs was another one. At Churchill's insistence, there was a British delegation team sent off to Los Alamos. And then after World War II, Klaus Fuchs headed up the British atomic weapons program. He had provided a lot of information to the Soviets about the uranium device, the fission rate, all these basically anything Clausewitz got his hands on, he sent off, you know, via cutouts and couriers to the Soviets. So the end result was the Soviets had created their first nuclear weapon based on the plutonium device, right? Because Leslie Groves, General Leslie Groves, ordered a crash production course on both the uranium-235, what became known as the gun barrel device, and then the more complicated plutonium-239 device, right? And so that was a crash course the Soviets did, but it only took them about 5 years or so to develop their own nuclear weapons program. Igor Kurchatov was, if memory serves, the head of the Soviet nuclear weapons program. They had multiple sources. So if this is a hoax, well, they've also fooled Soviet intelligence to the point where, you know, somehow with all that hoaxed information, they detonated their own nuclear weapon, which was basically a carbon copy of the Fat Man plutonium nuclear device dropped on Nagasaki. And speaking of Nagasaki, there were a number of Marines, U.S. Marines, who visited Nagasaki shortly after the nuclear blast. They came down with cancer. And then you have the ostracized people in Japan who've somehow survived the nuclear blast, and their descendants, for whatever reason, they are looked down upon by the other Japanese, stigmatized for whatever reason. So if this is a hoax, then, you know, all their radiation-induced mutations, illnesses, etc., are part of that hoax. And like I said, it's not only the U.S. and Japan, but places like Australia, where there have been there's been a royal commission in Australia, eyewitnesses, firsthand testimony from military personnel and civilians, including Aboriginals, who were irradiated by these were British atomic tests. The British could care less about what happened to the people in Australia, and could care less about what happened to the, you know, Australian military personnel, because they looked on the Australians in general as provincials, as you know underlings, right? The head of the British Atomic Committee that oversaw the nuclear test in Australia was William Penny, who was also part of the Manhattan Project. William Penny was, if you ask me, the guy was a psychopath, right? He was a functional psychopath. And the British didn't even want to share the information with their Australian counterparts. They wanted to keep it all to themselves. One of the reasons why Charles de Gaulle, among others, went ahead with the nuclear program in France was they wanted to be a nuclear power. And they didn't want it to rely on the U.S. because de Gaulle had some quite understandable misgivings from his days being a U.S. ally in World War II and a British ally in all the assassination attempts he survived, not only from the OAS, the secret army organization that was set up in the wake of de Gaulle's giving Algeria back to the Algerians, oh, perish the thought, but because of his, long before that, because of his perceived intransigence and obstinacy, there were alleged to be assassination attempts on him by the so-called Allies during World War II. And he threatened after World War II, in the years after World War II, to foment closer ties with the Soviets because he trusted them more than the Americans and the British, understandably. So he wanted France to be a nuclear power, and other French politicians wanted France to be a nuclear power, hence the nuclear weapons test by the French government in so-called French Polynesia. Actually, the first four French nuclear tests was in Algeria in the Sahara Desert, and not surprisingly, many Algerians suffered the ill effects from those nuclear weapons tests. As far as French Polynesia was concerned, the French in the 1960s, conducted something like 193 nuclear tests there. Needless to say, many Polynesians got sick and died as a result of all these nuclear tests. And then in the 1990s, when the French announced they wanted to do more nuclear testing, not surprisingly, people in Tahiti and elsewhere in French Polynesia rioted. All these countries with nuclear weapons, and then you have the Chinese and their nuclear tests at Lop Nor, highly classified. Actually, the Soviets and the CIA, the KGB and the CIA and the GRU all colluded together to spy on the Chinese nuclear test at Lop Nor, because the Soviets, perennially mistrustful, perennially suspicious, perennially paranoid, because, you know, reptile regimes are perennially paranoid, were freaking out over the thought of the Chinese developing nuclear weapons. Where is Lop Nur? Lop Nur is in the disputed Zhangjiang region, the western province, northwestern province of China. And the Uyghurs, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, the ethnic Uyghurs, they say they're not Chinese. They were basically assimilated into China. And then, especially since China became a communist country, they wanted no part. The Uyghurs, let me see if I can spell that for you, U-Y-G-H-U-R, is a largely Muslim population. And they've had a large separatist movement there for some time now. To no one's surprise, the CIA has tried to stir up the Muslim population in this province of China. So where does China decide to have their nuclear test? Of course, in Zhangjiang province, where all these Uyghurs are, who don't like the Chinese and don't want to be part of China. So the Chinese set off a bunch of nuclear tests there, and according to some estimates, 750,000 people died. So, you know, that's another example of this nuclear wasteland that's rapidly spreading around our planet. And also, you have places like Semipalatinsk, which is in the northeast part of Kazakhstan, also known as the Polygon, and it was the primary testing site for the Soviet Union's nuclear weapons. It's a radiation zone. It's a highly contaminated place. Like Lop Nor, like the southwestern U.S., which is an irradiated place, like Maralinga in Australia and Montebello Island, these are all nuclear wastelands. And speaking of espionage, you know, we can't, you know, complete this discussion about atomic espionage without talking about Israeli nuclear espionage, the infamous NUMEC espionage case. NUMEC was a nuclear materials engineering corporation, I think that's the name of it, in Pennsylvania, Apollo, Pennsylvania, where throughout the 1960s, there was a huge, huge hemorrhage of stolen information, stolen materials, stolen nuclear materials out of Apollo, Pennsylvania, the nuclear power facility there, and probably others, which was sent off to Israel, where the Israelis developed their own nuclear weapons capability. The infamous Dimona underground nuclear production plant beneath the Negev Desert. And then we have the Sephardic Jew, Mordecai Vanunu, one of the true heroes of history. He was actually an engineer, a technician working in Dimona in the underground weapons plant, and he took a bunch of photographs, smuggled them out. He gave them to the London Sunday Times. I forget which newspaper it was, but the newspaper in London came out with a front page spread complete with photographs showing the inside of this nuclear plant, showing all the centrifuges, showing all the different departments that Mordecai Vanunu had access to. And this caused Well, it should have been a bigger scandal, but it wasn't because of the, you know, control of the world's, you know, most of the world's media at the time and still to this day. But experts took a look at the photographs and, you know, after talking to and debriefing Mordechai Vanunu, they estimated that the Israelis were capable of, you know, up to that time, they could have had as many as 500 nuclear weapons, right? And it's interesting how art imitates life. A lot of times, they have a genre called faction nowadays, where you have these real-life stories and, you know, names, places, some of the details have been changed, and then they call it a novel, so it's a fiction, but it's really a faction because they're introducing a lot of real information in it, right? And a lot of information comes out in the form of these faction novels and then later on are admitted to as being real, right? And then more details emerge, real names, places, agencies involved, right? In a book written by one of my favorite authors, Mark Abernethy, he writes a series of novels, or had written a series of novels, about an Australian super spy for ASIS, Australian Secret Intelligence Service, a covert paramilitary operative kind of guy. And in one of the novels, Second Strike, it's about this terrorist attack that was initially blamed on Muslim terrorists in Indonesia, which killed a lot of Australians and a lot of other foreigners, as well as a lot of Indonesians. And just like the Bali bombings in October 2002, it emerged that, in all likelihood, based on the research, this super spy, Alan McQueen is his name in the novels, he teams up with a counterpart in Indonesian intelligence, as well as a Mossad guy who at first he thought was a Russian spy, turned out to be a Russian who was a Mossad spy. And then it emerges that what really happened in this novel, this bomb that went off, was actually a micro nuke that was developed by the Israelis. Go figure, right? It's an example of art imitating life, where somewhere along the way, I'm sure this Mark Abernethy guy got the idea of weaving into the story the concept of a micro mini nuke. But the fact that he would mention that in the novel that the nuke originated from Israel, and then through a series of misadventures, double cross, et cetera, somehow it got into the hands of, you know, Pakistanis and the infamous Dr. A.Q. Khan, who was the guy who developed the Pakistani nuclear weapons program. Actually, he was being funded through the Bank of Commerce and Credit International, BCCI, which was set up by Paki ISI, Paki Intelligence, and the CIA, right? So actually, in a very real way, the CIA was funding, you know, Professor A.Q. Khan's nuclear weapons development program in Pakistan. Anyway, in the novel, this Israeli-made micro nuke, in a sort of double cross, winds up with the Pakistanis, and then winds up in the hands of these Muslim terrorists who set it off at a busy nightclub in Indonesia, right? And then, as the author pointed out, the mini nuke originated in Israel. Go figure, right? So, I don't know. Was that a case of art imitating life? Who knows? But it cycles back to what I pointed out at the outset of this commentary. The Bali bombing, in all likelihood, was a micro nuke, a mini nuke. There was a very large crater, which could not have been created by conventional, any kind of plastic explosives, no matter how high-tech or highly refined, could not have created such a large crater, which was quickly, you know, filled in by the authorities. And another problem, which I mentioned at the outset, the victims were literally atomized, blown apart, where they couldn't even find the remains of most of the people who disappeared. The interview with the guy, the military terrorism specialist, who said that, you know, right before the blast, all the power went out. And then during that interview, they actually cut it off because, you know, there was some sensor who was switched on and realized that, you know, by mentioning that the power had been knocked out in the immediate neighborhood, that suggested that there was some kind of EMP, electromagnetic pulse, which doesn't come from plastic explosives or from a, you know, fertilizer bomb, you know, whatever excuse they come up with, right? This was a sophisticated device. And it should be noted that over the years in the U.S. inventory, and this has even been mentioned by people like, you know, the founder of SEAL Team 6, Richard Marcinko, that a number of these small atomic demolition munitions, SADM, so-called backpack nukes, have just up and disappeared from the U.S. inventory. Is it any wonder, considering NUMEC, like, for example, all the theft of the nuclear weapons information, nuclear materials out of the plant in Pennsylvania, and going back to the enormous code name, gigantic Soviet espionage effort, right? David Greenglass was a very low-level spy. All he did was, you know, he was coerced into espionage by his brother-in-law, who he looked up to, Julius Rosenberg. All David Greenglass, who was a member of the U.S. Army, what were known as SED, Special Engineering Detachments at Los Alamos, which was the military technicians. And all he did was pass on information about the lens, you know, the explosive lens, which were used to create an implosion, a symmetrical inward blasting, perfectly symmetrical shockwave that compressed the plutonium 239 core or pit in the supercriticality. So, you know, keep that in mind, that, you know, Greenglass was just one example of a spy out of Los Alamos, but there were many others. So, you know, the whole moral of the story is, are all these sick people that have been irradiated in these nuclear tests above ground, that jolt of an earthquake I felt when I was at the UFO Congress in the early 1990s, which turned out to be an underground nuclear test, the overhead imagery of the Mercury test site, which shows dozens of big craters, like just holes all over the central Nevada desert where they set off these nukes underground, the Bali bombing, the irradiated soldiers who've and airmen and sailors who've taken part in these nuclear and thermonuclear tests in the Pacific, the nuclear test in the Nevada desert, the nuclear test in Australia, Montebello Island, and at Maralinga. All those people that got sick, civilian and military alike, and died, many died. All the babies who died after the spike, you know, the spike of childhood mortality, infant, toddler mortality in the days, weeks, and months after the nuclear test in America. Are all that part of the hoax, right? You have to ask yourself, the aliens' extreme interest in, you know, the 1975 low-level incursions over the Northern Tier Strategic Air Command bases, Malmstrom, Minot Air Force Base, Grand Forks Air Force Base, Loring Air Force Base, the UFOs shadowing the Franklin Roosevelt aircraft carrier, which, unbeknownst to many, were carrying nukes, the special forces that have been trained, including Soviet and now Russian GRU Spetsnaz, right? Spetsnaz is the special forces which answer to GRU's Russian military intelligence, and they're trained to deploy their version of SADMs, the creation of micro nukes, right? And there's even rumors that micro nukes have been created that give out little or no nuclear fallout, little or no nuclear signature. Now, as crazy as that seems, go back to the 1950s with Eisenhower. What did he call the program? Atoms to Plowshares or some stupid name like that, where they were going to use nuclear weapons for peaceful purposes, like, you know, boring out tunnels and tunnel complexes and whatnot. But what you know, what many people felt at the time and to this day is that that was a hint that there was already nuclear weapons available that gave off very little fallout, that gave off very little, you know, beta and gamma particles, right? So keep all this in mind, that they may already have developed micro nukes, which give off a very low or non-existent radiation signature, which cannot be detected by normal Geiger counters and the like. It's possible this whole nuclear weapons are a hoax meme is an opportunistic attempt to kind of hijack the fact that so many people, so many activists, so many private investigators are unmasking and revealing these hoaxed events. Boston bombing, hoax. Sandy Hook, hoax. So the term false flag and the term hoax is already embedded in the minds of many people nowadays. So you have these people come along and say, oh, nuclear weapons are a hoax. And, you know, capitalizing on the fact that many people are aware of the role the tribalist collectivists play. So that's going to have an effect on people who have a visceral hatred of Jews and a visceral hatred of the Zionists in particular, right? Oh, okay, well, that makes sense to me, to someone who has an absolute, you know, frothing at the mouth hatred for the tribalist collectivists. And then by saying that it's a hoax, nuclear weapons, that kind of piggybacks on and hangs onto the coattails of all these other hoaxes, which we know to be hoaxes, like Boston Marathon, like Sandy Hook, etc., etc., right? It's gotten to the point now that when the Syrian Air Force blasted that warehouse that happened to have chemical weapons, and, you know, the pictures were coming out of the white hat people, bought and paid for, Soros-funded, George Clooney glorified white helmets, people were saying, oh, that's a hoaxed event. No, it wasn't hoaxed. It was real. Those are real dead people. Those are real children. The children and people were kidnapped from pro-Assad areas and murdered, and then, you know, their bodies were laid around, and they're claiming that they were killed by a Syrian government nerve agent attack. So you see how it's getting mixed up in people's minds, or there's deliberate confusion. There's deliberate confusion while people are saying, oh, that whole thing with Assad's doing a nerve gas attack, that is a hoax. Look, the babies are not really dead. No, they're dead, but Assad didn't do it. They were killed by the Soros-funded, NATO-funded white helmet types who were trained, and the ISIS, Daesh, ISIL types were trained in the deployment of chemical weapons. They were killed all right, and they may have been killed even with chemical weapons. They may have been killed from the leakage from the chemical weapons storage depot that was blasted, apparently, in a Syrian Air Force raid. So, you know, it's not a hoax. The people were dead enough. They were killed in what's clearly an illegal war. So the utilization of the term hoax is being used deliberately to create confusion. And here's another thing, too. It's gotten to the point now that they're saying, oh, Fukushima. Fukushima's a hoax, too. It's not real. Fukushima's fake, right? So you see how far they're taking this, where by implying that nuclear weapons are a hoax, by implying that Fukushima's a hoax, well, this is tantamount saying that there's no nuclear plants around that are leaking all this radiation and, you know, toxicity into the environment. That's a hoax, too. You see where this leads, right? For people who don't really understand and haven't taken the time to study and research these things, right? So keep all that in mind. I mean, that was a big part of a lot of the cover-ups with, you know, certain accidents, let's say, involving nuclear submarines and whatnot in the open ocean, you know, in the old days with Soviet and American submarines playing cat and mouse in the ocean and collisions and the sinking of certain American and Russian nuclear-powered submarines. All that was covered up. All that was covered up to this day. If it was a hoax, if it was meant even to be a limited hangout, they would make more of an effort to get that information out. But it hasn't come out. It's been severely covered up. The low-level flying saucer and UFO incursions over the Strategic Air Command bases covered up for years until information was pried out via the Freedom of Information Act and also the whistleblower testimony, people like Robert Salas, etc. We wouldn't know about these things. And it's when I say we, it's only a small percentage of the population, those of us who actually care about this information. The lamestream, you know, the thundering herd out there, they don't know and they don't care. So how can it be a hoax if it's only targeting a tiny percentage of the people, i.e. those people who know that hoaxes and false flags are being perpetrated by the controlling factor, right? It's being used, this term hoax, as a means to muddy the water. And so let's see where this leads. Let's see. Because if all these so-called non-existent backpack nukes start going off and then they blame it on ISIS, right, which apparently has training camps all over the place, and if these backpack nukes start going off all over the place, people will point to, oh, look at these truthers, these activists. First they said the Boston Marathon was a hoax and Sandy Hook was a hoax. And then they started saying nuclear weapons are a hoax. They're part of the problem. You see? See how easy that is to start to demonize people? So the moral of the story, folks, is, you know, make up your own mind about these things. But, you know, really just go within and just intuit and use your own intuitive powers to determine what's real or what's not, and back it up with a lot of diligent research too. Anyhow, we've reached the end of this week's segment of Bartley's Commentaries on the Cosmic Wars. Wherever you may be, dear listeners, whatever you may be doing, have a very pleasant night or day. Thank you.